Hi, everybody. I'm Mike Cuthbert in Washington. Welcome to Primetime Radio. One of the puzzling things about the American political debate in recent years has been the tenacity with which certain individuals and groups have argued that there is no climate change, no global warming. There's nothing we need to do, as far as human activity is concerned, to rectify a situation that does not exist. We've even reached a point at which an American president can propose a $1.2 billion program to develop vehicles propelled by hydrogen fuel cells. Now, this is a development made necessary by climate change, while the same president and the oil companies that support him deny climate change has been proven. Charles Wolforth, an Anchorage native, has written articles for the New Republic, Outside, and other magazines. In his new book, The Whale and the Supercomputer, he takes us inside the labs where they're studying climate change in the Arctic regions and inside the villages where lives depend on the whale hunt and on ice conditions, which are interrelated. In effect, Wolforth is telling two stories, but both point in an incontrovertible direction. There is a human component to climate change. It is related to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and dangerous signs of deterioration are already present and accelerating. He joins us from Alaska Public Radio in Anchorage to tell us what he saw and what he discovered. Our thanks to engineers Ron Zastro and Michelle Wozniak for their help in getting us connected with Anchorage. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you very much.
Why is the Arctic a more critical area to study in this regard than the other cold region in the world, Antarctica?
Well, the theories and the predictions about how climate change would happen all point to the Arctic being first and fastest in warming. And the basic reason for that is one that is simple in conception. That is that the Arctic is white in the wintertime with sea ice and with snow on the land. And in the summertime, there's much more of it is open water and is green tundra. Well, naturally, white snow reflects most of the energy from the sun back into space, so that helps cool the Earth. When that snow is gone, when that ice is gone, the Earth absorbs most of the energy from the sun. As climate change accelerates, and as we've seen over the last couple of decades, the winters are shorter, so there's more time period without snow, without ice. So therefore, the Earth is absorbing more energy in the north. And so it's a what they call a positive feedback loop. In other words, each year when there's less snow, there's more warming.
I'm curious, since we're talking primarily about the Arctic, but people are concerned about global warming all over, what's the difference between the effect of changes in plant growth and the tundra from, let's say, Montana or Wyoming, where they also have a lot of snow, and plants cycle there? Why is it so much more critical in the Arctic?
Well, there's several reasons. One is that, in most parts of the country, the ecological regime is set by man. Let's face it, farms and ranches, and we kind of determine what's going to grow there.
Right.
In the Arctic, it's a great wilderness, and so nature really has its own hand. And we're seeing a change from a vegetation types that, that had been there probably since the last ice age of tundra in the Arctic to more bushes and shrubs, which tend to also, again, warm the earth more. The other factor is that we've got the Arctic is frozen, not only on the ocean, but also on the land. Permafrost is just under the surface, and it's ground that's been frozen for tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of years. And when plants decay, die, they fall on this cold or frozen ground, and they don't decay. So enormous quantities of carbon dioxide are also contained in this frozen layer or very cold layer of ground. And one of the experiments that's been done, which is somewhat alarming, shows that as the Arctic warms and this material warms, a lot of that decay is going to accelerate, and that CO2 will enter the atmosphere, and it's on a scale of all of the burning of fossil fuels we've already done, if somehow catastrophically all of that decay were to take place at once.
Our guest is Charles Wolforth. His book is The Whale and the Supercomputer on the Northern Front of Climate Change. So far, we've been discussing the things that have been discussed in the laboratory, rather, biology, plant study, and so forth, botany. But let's turn the study more archaeological or anthropological. Discuss the Inupiaq Eskimos and their history in Point Barrow and why they're important to this story.
Well, they're a fascinating people in many ways, but one of the most interesting things about them with relation to this is that their culture really was molded in a very clear way by climate change that occurred in the past. The Inupiaq are the Eskimos of northern Alaska, and they live by whaling. Whaling is really the key to their culture and the key to their subsistence going back 1,000 years. And it was a past climate warming called the medieval warm period when they developed this whaling technology and the ability to pursue the whales on open water. And in that time period, there wasn't so much ice, and their culture was able to spread all the way across the Arctic. So the culture that developed here in Alaska went all the way across northern Canada to Greenland, and there's still language similarities and even stories that an elder in Greenland can tell and an elder in Alaska will recognize, although there's no memory of communication between them for perhaps 1,000 years. Hmm. Well, around 1200 AD, the climate changed again and became much colder. And now these widely dispersed people, in order to continue whaling, had to concentrate into large villages and had to be able to do something that technologically is pretty incredible even now, which is that they get all of their equipment perhaps 10, 12 miles out on the ice to where there would be an open lead in the water, that is, the ice would be broken. And this was something that now, under this colder climate, in this little ice age period that began around 1200 AD, was much more difficult. You had to go quite a long way. So they had to develop the coordination and cooperation to get out there and then to harvest a whale and then haul a whale that could weigh 100,000 pounds or more back to the village and store it in the ice. And that is the source of their culture that exists now, which is a highly cooperative culture, a highly egalitarian culture, one that's able to, you know, work together and to survive in this very hostile environment.
Well, it seems to me you point out rather conclusively that there's something more to the story, and that's how the whale and the supercomputer come together. And that is as important as the subsistence hunting of whales is to them, so is their knowledge of the behavior of ice necessary often, as you point out, to avoid loss of life when those leads start to close up or the ice starts to flow back in toward the shore.
Yeah, I had the privilege, the enormous privilege, to spend quite a bit of time on the sea ice with the Inupiaq Eskimos of Barrow on their whaling hunt. And listeners can actually see some pictures of that on my website, which is whaleandsupercomputer.com. And I've done some lectures around the country showing some of these photos. These people still pursue the whaling that they've done for 1,000 years, and they do it with the knowledge and the ability to perceive what's happening out in the environment that developed over those 1,000 years. So they have a language, and they have a way of life and a social structure, if you will, that allows many people dispersed over the ice to look at what's happening in their particular area, to know the dynamics and the engineering of that ice, if you will, how the bottom of the ocean is shaped, how the currents are running, to confer with each other in their Inupiaq language, which is extraordinarily well suited to transferring this information, and then to reach a conclusion as a group as to whether it's safe to stay where they are, whether they need to pull back to shore, and what the conditions foretell for what will happen on the ice. And this ability is recognized certainly by scientists, most of whom won't go out on the ice without an Inupiaq guide. Even the top ice scientists know that Inupiaq hunters know the ice better than they do. And so the question then became, how can science gain some access into this extraordinary knowledge and ability to understand what's happening there?
How successful have they been at relating what their computers tell them and what the Inupiaq tell them?
Well, not as much as you might initially hope, because science is used to, we've all heard the phrase anecdotal evidence, right? That's the killing phrase, that well, my grandmother took this and got better. Well, that's anecdotal evidence. Science really wants numbers and wants something that can be put into a computer and spit out the same answer no matter who's doing it. And the traditional knowledge of these native hunters is based on their experience and what they've learned from their elders and from generations past. it's a kind of knowledge that's maybe not even verbal at times, where people are standing together out in the environment and seeing how things change and learning those patterns. And the there have been some successes where you know, a scientific expert can sit down with a native expert and they can talk as equals and begin to transfer some of their knowledge back and forth. There's certainly many things that science knows that are not part of the Inupiaq culture. But more often, it's been a case where a scientist will, you know, show up in the village with a survey and say, well, what was the weather like, you know, on October 15th, 2000? And an elder will sort of look at him with a confused look in his eye. So it's a very difficult translation between these two kinds of knowledge. The other success that's happened that I observed are some scientists who are kind of adapting something of the intuitive outlook, the experiential outlook of the natives, and actually spending more time in the outdoors, spending more time in the Arctic, and learning to see, you know.
Duh.
Right. Well, I talked to one very smart mathematician and computer modeler named Glenn Liston. He's with the Colorado State University at Fort Collins. And, you know, he spends his time with computers. He spends his time showing what snow does on the landscape. But he spent many weeks out in super cold weather in the Arctic. And the reason was he wanted to know snow. He wanted to be able to look at the snow in the computer and know from his experience if it was right or not. And I think we all realize deep down that we do have this intuitive ability to understand things that goes beyond what we read in books and what we do with numbers. But many scientists have a hard time with that concept.
We're talking with Charles Wolforth in Anchorage, Alaska. His book is The Whale and the Supercomputer on the Northern Front of Climate Change. Since there was a medieval warm period 1,200 years ago, why isn't what we're going through now perhaps another medieval warm period? In other words, why is this not just cycling back and forth?
Well, that's really the great debate as to how much of what's happening in the Arctic right now is a cycle and how much is a trend or a one-way progression from cooler to warmer. Most scientists believe, in fact, I don't think I've met any up here in Alaska who don't, that there's a combination of both going on, that there's certainly some kind of cyclic change that happens, and then there's also a trend that's rising. The reason for believing in the cycles is that we've seen evidence that there are cycles in the past of various lengths, and one that's certainly well established is the ice ages, which we call the glacial and interglacial periods, which range from up to 100,000 years in length, or, you know, some are 21,000 years in length, and these are, you know, warm-cold cycles that have been going on for a couple of million years. There also appears to be something like a 1,500-year cycle, and there also seem to be 50-year cycles. And teasing out all these cycles of warm and cold is a very difficult job that's being done by scientists studying weather records, but even more so studying tree rings and other environmental records. But then when you get to the question of, well, is this just a cycle, you run up against some problems with that hypothesis. One is that these tree rings and other records show that it's never been this warm in over 1,000 years, and that it's warming at a much faster rate than it has at any time in the past, and this warming is taking place simultaneous with an increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is unprecedented in over 500,000 years. More carbon dioxide now in the atmosphere than any time in the last 400,000 years.
Is there any indication that CO2 is the product of anything other than human consumption and the waste product of it?
Well, in this climate change debate, many things are debated, but one that's not is the quantity of carbon dioxide that humans are emitting.
Okay.
And that's very well established. And just to give people not too many numbers, but to throw in some numbers just for an order of scale here, before we started burning fossil fuels in the 19th century, the atmosphere had about 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide. Now that number is up above 380 parts per million, and it goes up about 3 parts per million every year based on the fuel we burn in our cars and in our factories and in our homes. So that part of the equation is known. It's also known that carbon dioxide does cause the atmosphere to warm. In fact, if you're building an instrument to measure carbon dioxide, you You take the carbon dioxide, put it in a chamber, and shine a light on it and see how much it warms. That's how well that is known, and it's been known since the 19th century. So those two facts are very well known. The only question that's not known is how much of the warming we're seeing now is caused by that, and how much would have happened anyway, which is a little bit of an academic issue. We certainly know well enough that the carbon dioxide would cause warming, and we know we have warming happening now.
Yeah.
So the question of how much is caused by one thing and how much is caused by another is maybe not as great a import as just the question of, well, it's happening, what are we going to do about it?
I want to touch on something else that became a popular miss or conception, depending on your point of view, thanks to the movie The Day After Tomorrow. And I gather from your book, though you didn't use Day After Tomorrow as your example, that thermohaline circulation is what could have caused the creators of that movie to create the scenario in which in a very quick time the entire northern tier of states, including New York City, freeze over in a matter of moments. What is thermohaline circulation, and how is it related to that general scenario of gradual and distinct cooling?
One of the things that has been found as scientists have studied climate change and what has happened to climate in the past is a big surprise, which is that climate can change very, very abruptly. And so there's been an effort to reach into this climate record that's found in, you know, ice cores and tree rings and so forth, and find evidence for what would have possibly caused that. What would be the trigger for, you know, a sudden 10-degree change in temperature in a certain area of the world? And the best candidate so far is this thermohaline circulation, which is essentially the conveyor belt current in the Atlantic Ocean, wherein the warm water, which is heated at the equator by the sun, moves northward on the surface, and then the cold water from the Arctic, which is saltier, sinks down and moves back to the equator at the bottom of the ocean, and then comes upward again, so that it's this circular conveyor belt. That's thermo, which is warmth, haline, which is salt, thermohaline circulation. Well, the theory that has more and more adherence is that if you have a warming in the Arctic and a lot of ice melts, that'll put a lot of fresh water on the surface of the Arctic Ocean,
right,
and could potentially disrupt that thermohaline circulation, make it slow down or stop. And there's some very preliminary information that maybe the circulation is slowing down right now as a cause of the warming that's taken place.
That's a controversial theory, I realize. And yet, let's cut to the chase. You have a person in your book say, I think a lot of people are disconnected from climate because they're so insulated from it. Those of us here in Washington, of course, hear a lot about climate change. But how soon do you see this as being a threat to the lower 48?
Well, I'm one of those who is very hesitant to make predictions about nature and about things that are going to happen far in the future, because nature has a way of always confounding us and confounding our smartest ideas. You know, things happen, and there's a certain humility that's necessary in looking at the future. What I was trying to do with the book is show a place where climate change is already very real, and it's threatening people's lives and their livelihoods. It's forcing them to adapt their culture and their way of life. And when that will happen other places is very difficult to predict. Maybe it's already happening. You know, it's hard to tell with climate as to when a hot day is just a hot day and when it's part of climate change. But in any event, it's very clear that it's happening in the Arctic, and the Inupiaq are being forced to adapt to it. And that kind of makes it a case study for those of us who are going to come later to see how they deal with it as people, how they face those challenges, and how they make their world new with this new environment that they're going to be living in, as we all are.
Which begs the question, though, Charles, why is it so relatively easy to get $133 million for Antarctic study where there are no American people? There are no native people. There are penguins and various tracks of explorers, while the Arctic funding, with American citizens and native cultures involved, is so hard to get funding for.
It is very very ironic, and the Arctic researchers would love to hear your comment. you know, that Antarctica is a political realm as well as being a scientific realm. And there are some important scientific topics that are being studied there, including, you know, the ozone layer and the stability of the Antarctic glaciers. But I think it's clear that the Arctic is a place where climate change is really exciting in terms of a research topic. And yet, as you say, the money, it's something like 3-1 goes to the Antarctic. And I think the only explanation is really that by having those stations in the Antarctic, we are sort of placing the flag. You know, we're saying, well, we're active in the Antarctic, we're important. And there's also a certain romance, if you will. You know, the media loves to cover what's happening in the Antarctic. There's always stories going on about scientists going down there and staying for the winter and all that. And in the Arctic, where people are laying their lives on the line to continue their subsistence in a changing environment, it's a much more complex story. It's not exactly the brave explorer setting out into the icy waste.
What would happen? Let's assume that the CO2, carbon dioxide, is the villain. What would happen if all carbon dioxide emission was ended tomorrow? How soon would we see climate changes slow or even reverse?
Well, of course, it's really an impossibility to eliminate all our CO2 emissions. It's everything in our society is based on fossil fuels, and even, you know, the campfire that you burn at summer camp is releasing CO2. But if we could, it would still take quite a while to have the effect we'd like. I've been told that we've only got about half of the climate effect or the equilibrium from the CO2 we've already emitted. So the CO2 that's in the atmosphere, we have no way of taking it out. We've only had half the climate change that CO2 is going to cause.
Okay.
The best estimate seemed to be that if we were to go on a crash course of reducing carbon dioxide now, in about 150 years, we could reach an equilibrium point that would be 2 to 6 degrees warmer than the current temperatures on the Earth as an average.
Wow.
And just to give you an order of scale, the current temperature is about 14 degrees centigrade. So a substantial warming over we've got now, even if we take drastic action. Of course, if we don't take drastic action, then the sky's the limit, and our great-great-grandchildren will deal with a world that we have a hard time imagining.
Thanks for being our guest on the program. We really appreciate your information. The book is The Whale and the Supercomputer on the Northern Front of Climate Change, written by our guest Charles Wolfer. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And thank you at home for joining us on Primetime Radio. We invite you to call our toll-free number with reactions to our shows or any questions you may have. That number is 800-424-9343. Previous broadcasts of Primetime Radio, as well as information about our guests, are online at www.aarp.org/radio. Primetime Radio is a production of AARP. Our producer is Janelle Haskell, associate producer Aileen Ellis, our engineer Bruce Youngblood. I'm Mike Cuthbert in Washington.